To start out, I'll take the dictionary definition of the word vocation. First of all, it comes from a Latin word vocatio, which means a call or summons. And the first dictionary definition is an occupation, business or profession, a calling. And I think that's what most of us think of when we use the word casually in society, the word vocation. It's an occupation, it's a job. The second one is a strong impulse or inclination to follow a particular activity or career, a vocation to go after some job. The third one, a divine call to God's service or the Christian life. And the fourth one is a function or station in life to which one is called by God. And they have listed in the dictionary the vocation of marriage or the vocation of priesthood. And I would suggest that we're a very common usage of the word vocation is the first one, the occupation or job. The next one, which most people have a familiarity, is the concept of calling to the priesthood, calling to ordained ministry, calling to church positions. But very few times do we get into some of these middle definitions, and particularly the one of a divine call to God's service or to the Christian life. We see our faith as something that we're supposed to live out 7 days a week in everything we do, and our occupation is a big part of that, so it seems natural that when we look at what we mean by the word vocation, we look at that dictionary definition of it, a call to God's service. And it's also appropriate that the first definition of the word vocation is occupation, because when we talk about the concept of called to service, our job is the thing we contribute most to society. Our paid function is generally the number one thing that we see in terms of what do you do. Matter of fact, our whole identity is wrapped up with it. The first thing you do at places, certainly other than Holden, where maybe the second question you ask somebody is, where are you from? Or how long are you going to be here? But the typical question you'll have in society outside of here is, what's your name? And after that, well, what do you do? And it's very much of who we are and our self-image, as well as the image other people hold of us. So it's understandable and appropriate that when we talk about vocation, we may focus particularly, though not solely, on the concept of your occupation as we tie it into the call to service. And I'd like to suggest that there might be a commitment to, a hierarchy of commitments to occupation. Perhaps the bottom level is the job you're doing today, the function you're doing, you're hired to perform this task. Next highest level might be your occupation, what you do. You're a plumber, you're not just doing one job, but you are a plumber. Next one, I don't know which comes next in the hierarchy, maybe a profession or maybe a career. And something you've committed, talked to somebody today who worked 38 years for the same company, that's a pretty good long career. And then at the top of it may be where we put in the divine calling that we get, our baptismal call to serve others. So, as I said earlier, I don't think we should see it as just paid work, for one thing. Many people in our society never do perform paid work, and if we say they don't do anything of value, it's certainly a faux pas nowadays to say to somebody who spent their housewife or somebody who spent their time and years raising their kids for an unpaid work to say, what do you do? Oh, you don't work. I mean, as soon as you say that, oh, I didn't mean to say that. I realize kids are a lot of work and blah, blah, blah. We understand that work is not just what you do is paid work, but work, paid or unpaid. And obviously there's a distinction between unpaid work and volunteer work. And volunteer work and avocation or hobby. And the vocation that we have in terms of our position in life. My vocation as a parent is serving my family and kids, and my vocation as a friend is serving friends and being an ear when they need somebody to listen. So I'd like to start out by going through how I particularly saw the concept of vocation in my own trying to find my path, talk about it a little bit more, and then I hope basically open this up for a longer discussion of how we find calling, what calling means, and what vocation is. And again, I thought it was very appropriate at the dinner hour when Susan introduced the evening schedule, when she talked about our baptismal calling, because as Christians, I think we very much see that we get our calling from God at the time of our baptism. So if I start for myself, my vocation began December 2nd, 1956. And it's not something, well, you go to school, you do this, then you're an adult, now I'm going to go out and get a vocation. That's almost as bad as the old, or the not old, but the shallow understanding of vocation. The Christian concept of vocation is simply something that the people who are called to ordained ministry have. But I actually, at one point in my life, was going to be an ordained minister. I, as a little child, had many experiences that are, I think, eye-opening to children. Children have a very clear sense of right and wrong. They see something and they think, that's bad or that's wrong. Sometimes they need guidance in helping that, but I think they, more than adults, sometimes see things in black and white terms. And certainly for me, I had a number of experiences as a child related to certain injustices in the world, and there are certainly plenty of them. As a 6 or 5 year old, I happened to be attending with family a conference at a Southern black college that Martin Luther King was speaking at, and it was a hot summer day in Virginia, and we were part of our vacation. This conference that Dad was at was part of our vacation, and so we were all along, and we were staying in these dorm rooms, and I remember they'd have the conference meetings of the ministers would be in the lounge, and we'd be tiptoeing up the stairs not to disturb anyone. And we undoubtedly stood out. We were only the only white family at the conference. But I still remember very vividly, even though I was 5 or 6 years old, Martin Luther King put me and my brothers up in a tree and was playing with us. And I wouldn't remember that other than the fact that we were told many times after that that he was a very great man. That was before he won the Nobel Prize and before other things happened. But still, I wouldn't particularly remember if there were other people who played with us, but he stood out because, one, he was unusual. I mean, there are lots of adults at a lot of conferences who don't go around and play with the kids of other people at the conference. Holden Village may be a good exception to that. But he stood out, one, because he was very friendly and playful, and number two, because our parents told him this playful man was a very great individual. And then I remember about 6 years later, when he was assassinated, my older brother's classmates in school, he came home and said, yeah, one of his friends said, they finally killed that nigger. And little kids see the injustice in that, and how sick that is, that somebody who could be that friendly, that playful, that something else, that somebody else actually cheers that they're killed. And we saw many experiences with poverty and so on. And so why did that call me? Why did I start as a 10, 12-year-old kid in feeling a calling to ordained ministry? Well, the people I knew who were involved in the civil rights movement or the anti-poverty movement or whatever, they were all ordained clergy. I mean, you walk, the only whites who you would see in the civil rights marches were all in wearing clerical collars, or they were nuns in their habits. And because of their clothing, it was very distinctive and you could tell. But I thought that, well, if you think these things are wrong and you want to do something about it, you go into the ordained ministry. And I suppose it took me a year to figure out that the only reason clergy were doing this was because they were upset at the way things were, and they were frustrated that others weren't doing enough, so they saw it as something that they had to speak out of. but that's not the primary function of going into ordained ministry to protest against certain injustices in society. So I moved on. Well, maybe social work was what I saw, and I suppose that's what I wanted to be through high school. And at some point I realized, boy, I love photography, and I wanted to be a professional photographer too, and maybe I could tie that in and do documentary photography. Some powerful books that bring to light certain injustices. So I wanted to be that for a number of years. And I don't know, somewhere along the line I got involved in recognizing that a lot of the injustices that were taking place were because of unjust laws and unjust policies. So I gradually gravitated after college to political type work, and from there it was a natural step to go into elective office. But as I try to relay that, I think that when you have a concept of what you are called, how you are called to serve, we all come up with different ways, and once we see our call, what job does that mean you plug into? You know, I was all over the board before I was 15 years old, and I think little kids ought to and do dream about what they want to be when they grow up, and some of us still keep thinking, what do we want to be when we grow up? And I guess I think that that's all part of our vocational search, and a healthy thing. And when we're looking for it, sometimes we look for very grandiose things. I guess I hope a lot of kids start out with grandiose plans and dreams of what they might want to be. Maybe I'm going to be the one who's going to find a cure for cancer. I mean, intertwined with my ideas about serving, I also wanted to be a professional hockey player, and I couldn't be that, a professional football player. And at some point I saw something where I once said I wanted to be a professional window washer too. I'm not quite sure how that fit in, but kids do have their dreams, and they usually evolve around something that they think is fun to do, that's a pleasure to do, and it's intertwined with things that they think they'd be good at, things that they'd want to help out with. And certainly finding a cure for cancer would be one of them. But others of us, and as we mature, as we grow older, we realize it's not just the unique contributions that one or two people find a vaccination for polio. We can't all do that. We don't need us all to do that. You only need one person to do that. And you need, well, thousands of scientists to find a cure for something. But there are many other ways we are called to serve. The Sharon and Alan's presentation a couple hours ago, one of the things that was constant in the movie they showed is people with cerebral palsy who are complaining that people don't take the time to listen, because it takes them quite a while to communicate some basic thoughts, and because it's hard for them to communicate, we don't want to listen and we don't find out what they have to say. A lot of people, we all have a sense of a need to be heard and need to be listened to, and a friend to people who are lonely might be the best way to put it. I mean, that's a true calling, and it's no less important to the people who you're providing the service to than people you help by finding some medical cure or something else. So we look at the grandiose schemes that we hope kids particularly dream of doing, because we need those great scientists and great philosophers and great artists and so on. We also need the things that are much more routine. Let me step and suggest in the art field about calling, and again, this is to help make it clear that this concept of vocation is not a new one. Johann Sebastian Bach, every piece of work he did, whether it was sacred or secular music, everything he signed in Latin, Soli Deo Gloria, to God alone the glory, because he felt everything he wrote was a talent given him by God and a particular service, all of the glory of which should go to God. But let me take the other end, the more simple concept. More ordinary type of job, less extraordinary type of thing. And to that I will go to my elementary school, an individual named Chester. Chester was school custodian or janitor. And I say Chester because I don't know his last name. It's 30 some years ago. And everybody else, if I think back of my elementary school, was Mrs. Holt, the principal, or Mrs. Johnson, the teacher, or everybody was Mrs. or Mr. or something or another. There was no first name basis back then, and maybe there is still some of that now. But Chester was different. Everybody knew him as Chester. Everybody called him Chester. And he had a very clear vocation, too. I don't know if Chester ever had a philosophical thought process going through about here's how he's called to serve others. But I'd say he served others in two ways. One, he kept the school building clean, which is a meritorious thing to do and a good way of service. Here at Holden, this is a good place to talk about vocation because everything people do around here in a small community like this, you see how it helps others. And because it's a volunteer community, we're doing it because we want to help. We want to contribute so we all can see it much more. But in the real world where people are paid to do things, janitor, what? Cleaning a school building, what's the service in that? That's your job. You punch the time clock and you do the job. Well, Chester did a good job, I'm sure. I frankly didn't pay that much attention to how dusty the rooms were or weren't. There was another custodian in the building, if I recall, and I don't even know his name. I can't even place the face. But I could pick Chester out of a police lineup anytime. And not that Chester would ever be in a police lineup. But his other calling, and the calling that related to his work but not related to the function of his job, was that he was a friend of everybody. If you ever, you know how kids in the school have their down days, and some kids nobody likes, and some kids get picked on, and everybody has their down moments. And Chester was always there, and always willing to listen, and always gave some friendly advice. And Chester had a true call to brighten up the days of the children in the school. And I keep thinking you couldn't have a job that in our society's scale of importance of things, custodian is not the highest. And so on, but yet he had a very clear calling in this Christian concept of vocation. Well, I'd like to address a couple issues related to vocation and so on, and then open it up because I think this is the kind of thing that I wanted to talk about this just because I'm trying to do thinking about that, and one of the reasons I like coming to Holden is because we have a chance to do that. So I want to hear what others have to say about it. But how do we know what our vocation is? Are we ever going to find it? Well, again, Plato said Socrates said the unexamined life is not worth living. Well, maybe not, but I'm not sure if Chester ever had a conversation. He may not have ever discussed the word vocation and the concept of calling. But certainly we as Christians do try and find how we fit into the world. I think everybody tries to find a way to fit in and how what their role is in life and how they can serve others. And what if we don't find it? I mean, I have some friends from college, and it's next year is my 20th reunion, so it's been a number of years. I know a number of friends from college who have gone from one thing to another. One guy went to law school because his father wanted him to, and then he went this, and then he went to that, and he went to medical school because his father wanted that, and because he didn't finish law school. And he became a doctor, and I'm not sure that's what his calling was. And he's still unhappy with it. And I've seen so many others who, again, the line, someday hope to find out what I want to be when I grow up. I hope we're all searching. And even when we're doing something we like, that we keep searching for new purpose, new meaning. But what if we, will we ever find? Well, I think most of us find it in maybe more than one way. I guess we all have a number of vocations. Our paid work, as I mentioned, family and friends, we have, because of our position in society, we have a calling. And again, going back to Chester as the example, I would argue that even in our jobs, there are many times when it's not the function of what we do, it's not how well we perform the task, but it's how we do in other ways that we serve others. When you're at a workplace where there is inappropriate behavior or harmful behavior to people, whether it's racism, whether it's sexual harassment, whether it's viciousness between some people and others, whether it's cheating on the job, whether it's stealing. There are times when it's very awkward to speak up, and the common thing we as humans want to do is just ignore the problem and pretend we didn't see it instead of confronting it. But that's a time when vocation shows through. Certainly, every place of employment has people who need, who are having particular problems where they need somebody who can listen to them or help them out. And our calling can be not necessarily just in the function of the job, but also in how we treat our coworkers or customers or others we deal with. Is calling a vocation something that's going to be pleasurable? Well, I guess I like to think your vocation, God doesn't necessarily call us to an easy life. I think that's clearly not the case. And we all have different types of talents. We all have different strengths and weaknesses. And maybe we're called to something that uses those talents. And yet, I don't think there's any reason to think it has to be something miserable. And certainly, we'll all look for things we enjoy doing. And certainly, tolerable jobs are better than intolerable ones, and pleasurable ones aren't. But I hope that we, in finding things around here, trying to encourage our son to do some volunteer work. Well, he picked one task he likes doing, and it's working at the snack bar. I'm not sure if it's because there's free ice cream or because easy work, but we've been trying to expand his horizons and get him to try something else. But there's nothing wrong with your calling being fun and pleasurable and other things, but recognize that we have a number of things we ought to be trying, and we have more than one calling, perhaps. And then finally, the callings change. There may be something where you've contributed. The individual I was talking to who this morning, who had spent 38 years for the same company, didn't do the same job all the time, tried different things. Late in career, was bored with what he was doing and felt he could contribute in some other way. And actually left when he was frustrated with something the company was doing and decided to find new ways of serving. And I think that we have to recognize that the search for vocation isn't something that is going to be settled, that, okay, now I got this job, I've been fighting it for it for years, now I finally have it, and now I don't have to worry about what my vocation is going to be, because, again, in the same way, it may take us a while to find what our vocation is. As soon as we find it, it may have changed on us, or we've changed in our needs, in our talents, and our skills have changed as well. But again, before opening it up for discussion, I wanted to suggest that Holden is a wonderful place to do this, both because we're all here at a time where you have a chance for a lot of reflection, and because of the very nature of the village. It's a small community, and it's not so impersonal when you're in a large city of a million people, and you perform one function out of 10,000 for a large company. You can't really see how your work may add to society. And around here, you can see every task that people perform here. You see how that contributes. And you also don't necessarily, or you probably, I would hope, at a place like this, don't have to deal with the other issue: what if your job, what if your vocation, what if your job is not a vocation in the sense that you don't believe in the product or the service that's being performed. I had one friend who worked he was an engineer who worked for a defense contractor and very well-paid job. He was fairly out of college for a few years, engineering program, and well-paid, good job, and he did not like the product, and he did not feel comfortable contributing to making Cold War weapons a decade ago. And so he left the company, chose an entirely new career because he wasn't comfortable with it, knowing full well that the day he left the company, they were going to hire somebody else to replace him, somebody with the same skills, somebody with the same things to plug into that role. And how do we do it? Because sometimes we are forced into positions in life where no choice seems good, no choice seems appropriate, and I guess I'd like to have us include that issue or problem in the discussion as well, because we don't have, life isn't always, boy, this is a clear cut, I'm going to do this and that's my way of contributing. Sometimes we do things, we don't have a choice but to do things that we're not comfortable with, and how do we wrestle with that as we discuss vocation? With that, I'd like to open it up for discussion. And where people are in their own, if people are searching or where.
One of the things that I was wrestling with after I graduated from college, I ran into Stringfellow's book, Nothing for Christians and Other Aliens in a Strange Land. And the whole notion for me, or the question for me was, how comfortable or how much my vocation could be a part of a culture that basically is moving in a different direction than my faith. And so I basically have chosen, I think sometimes subconsciously and sometimes very consciously, to take positions where I feel I have the flexibility to leave it, to pursue some other things, and some cases risk going to jail for, you know, taking stands and things like that. And so I guess wrestled with what it means to have a vocation in a context of looking at your society and whether or not you buy, how much you buy into the society by what you end up doing for earning a living.
Yeah, I think that's a good point in the fact that our faith is countercultural. I mean, Christ calls us to give when Madison Avenue tells us to take or to get. And given that, I mean, even a job that may be a, let's say, morally neutral position, you're not doing something to heal somebody who's sick or something. Well, working in retail, trying to help sell more clothing. Are we just, you feeding consumerism may help the bottom line for the company and so on, but is that the function itself may not be of Christian vocation. It may not be anti it either. It may be kind of neutral in that sense, but I think that's one thing we have to wrestle with.
Living in a community, I just use that word very different, or religious community use that word very differently than what the dictionary gave you or the interpretation, because a vocation for a religious person is lifelong commitment to God and God's people, and how you live that out day by day. And so when a religious person uses, I'm trying my vocation, they are in the process of trying to find out, is this going to be the life I want to live for the rest of my life? And so that's how we use vocation. And so when I think of my vocation, I think it's evolving every day. And until you die with your cross and your habit, you don't have a vocation, really. And so in religious terms, that's how we look at it. So vocation is trying to be what God called you to be day by day within the struggle in the context where you live. And I think basically that vocation calls you to dedication and prayer. And so sometimes when people say, you know, what do you do? I say, I pray. Because that's the center of my vocation, is to be able to pray and commune. and out of that center I move and do whatever else I do. So whatever I do outside of that has to reflect that call. And so for me, that's the vocation and that's the struggle. So it's always putting you into conflict. It's always going to challenge you to move beyond yourself. And I always say, you know, Jesus didn't promise you a rose bed. He said, you know, after you get crucified, you may get the crown. So you are always in the forefront. I think that's what this vocation puts you.
And I think the religious communities have a good way of phrasing it in terms of, I mean, everything we do is this call to service. I don't think that differs with that dictionary definition, the call to, I think it is call to service in the Christian life. And I guess I always see it in terms of how we serve others through our work, through our personal position in life, and you phrase it very neatly in terms of everything we do, which is, instead of saying your occupation, your family role and other things, it is everything. And the prayer and meditation that you see is part of the calling too, fits in. I mean, as Christians, I think we realize most of us don't do enough of it.
John, I'd share a short piece from Dietrich Bonhoeffer that I thought might apply here. When he was in prison, just before he was executed for his opposition to Hitler, he was in a moment of minor despair because the people in the prison to whom he was ministering saw him one way, and he knew himself to be something completely different. And he writes these words, "Who am I? They often tell me I would step from my cell's confinement calmly, cheerfully, firmly, like a squire from a country house. Am I then really all that which other men tell of? Or am I only what I know of myself, restless and longing and sick, like a bird in a cage? Who am I, this or the other? Am I one person today and tomorrow another? Am I both at once? Who am I? They mock me, these lonely questions of mine. Whoever I am, thou knowest, O God, I am thine." And that gets it for me, one of the wonderful things to talk about in terms of vocation is this notion of being and doing. Vocation starts with being. Not what you do. It starts, like Sister Rosina is saying, with the essence of yourself, and then you go and do something in furtherance of that. But what you do is not who you are. Bill Ricci, a brilliant president of PLU, used to stand up at the start of the school year and announce to the freshman class that he was not the president of Pacific Lutheran University. And they, you know, he intended to confuse them by that. And he was a brilliant speaker, like John's dad. And he would drag them on for 15 minutes weaving this thing. And finally he would say, "What I am is a child of God. What I do is run this university." And I think in terms of a vocation, in those terms, is that a job is something you're pushed into, and a vocation is something you're called into.
Right.
That the direction of the operative force in your life is 180 degrees difference. Being pushed and driven by the curse of work from Genesis 3, or being pulled into God's being and God's doing.
I like that, the way of phrasing it, the who I am is the child of God, yes. And again, we do have most of us need paid employment as well as other things, but again, the whole point of how we live out our vocation, again, doesn't have to be the job.
To bring being and doing
into one,
into harmony with one another. And when being and doing come into harmony, then you are in vocation. That might be a way to...
Yeah, and I guess I'd like to ask you or others about the concept, and again, Steve's point about how when you are in a society where I would suggest maybe most of the jobs are not ones where people can see how it fits in with their religious calling, that we started out by seeing it much too narrowly in terms of just the ordained ministry type of things. You are called to that, and God doesn't have much of a concern about what else we do. The rest of us do ordinary functions. And I think we all understand that, but I guess I think the point of how do you fit in with a lot of positions when in our society there are going to be a number of jobs that you don't believe in, and again, each one of us has to struggle with that. But if we ever came to a point where we could turn the world around in that way, how do we, I'm not sure how to ask it, but how do we plug into that? How do we resolve the issue where we want to fit in to the job market, to the economy, to the way of life that the world has? And certainly there are many places where we feel very clearly we can do that. I think we all struggle for that. But I think the moving, the being and doing together, it doesn't always work in the employment world, and I think that's where you make up for what we call vocation in other ways. You live out your calling in other ways than in your work.
Best way that ever worked for me was to visit people in their workplaces when I was their pastor, so that we could talk later about what they did and begin to merge Sunday and Monday, in a sense, and merge their worship and their work. And the surprise was most people had never given any thought at all that their pastor might visit them at their workplace. It was real weird. But it also turned out to be a terrific evangelism tool, because I would always ask for permission. I said, can I wear my collar? Not to make you feel awkward, but I want other people to know that you're with me and I'm with you, and I want, this is going to be the way. See, you're a shy person, aren't you? Oh yeah, I can't talk about my faith at all, Pastor. Well, we're going to make that easier.
You won't have to say it, it'll be obvious. Yeah.
I'm going to show up with you, and then one of your coworkers is going to come and say, who's the guy? You know, well, that's my pastor. You belong to a church? Yeah. And then suddenly the conversation is going to help them get over a hump. But, I mean, it was also a way of deeply affirming that Monday through Saturday wasn't something other than the church. The church wanted to be there too. And that, you know, in a sense, it was the beginning of spiritual direction one-on-one with those people, because after they knew where I worked, then they wanted to know how better to make that into vocation. And we started those conversations together.
I don't know about others' experience with that, but I was going to say, I think the church is, the church meaning us, has done a not very good job of making the connection between what we do on generally Sunday mornings and the rest of the week. And I think that's a very creative way to help make those connections. And I'm curious if others have had similar experiences, because I haven't seen a whole lot of cases where minister making calls does it to people at their workplace, and I can see how you have mutual benefits from that.
Yeah.
There was one in New Jersey, New York. The pastor used to go to the workplace And there was a rabbi who used to read on the train subway going to work upstate, and it turned out to be a lot of people joining him, and it became like a steady group as they traveled together. So you see, people are always curious to venture, and I believe that it's not the pastor alone who has this responsibility. It's all of us. All of us as human beings. And then those of us who call ourselves Christians have to set some good examples. And always, you don't have to wear badge. Action speaks louder than words. Sometimes the little kindness you show will indicate something. And New York City, for somebody to turn and ask you, and I wasn't wearing my cross, but something happened because I was following this gentleman, and he was trying to pull something from his pocket, and he dropped a $20 bill without knowing that he did that. And I was following him, so I picked it up, and I followed, and I tapped him on the shoulder, and he turned, and I said, "You dropped this." And he stopped dead in his tracks and looked at me, and so the next question was, "Are you a Christian?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "So am I." So we shake, and then we... But you see, that's a distinct action that somebody who didn't even know me from Adam asked me, "Are you a Christian?" So some of the little things we can do as people of God will distinct us or just make impressions in the workplace we do. Sometimes you're in a position of being with people who are under you. The treatment you give them will indicate a lot if you are a Christian or not.
And that's not to suggest that people who are not of Christian faith don't do kind, generous things too, but it's a good point. The other thing is your comment about how it's not just the role of clergy to go make the connections with the workplace and others. I keep thinking about how whenever churches do attempts to recruit more people and so on, oh, bring somebody to church Sunday, and so, well, you know, most of us do a pretty poor job of it. Well, our kids were given these invitations or something. They were supposed to bring some friend to church, and a neighbor girl, they invited her along, and she wanted to keep coming, so her father had to come too, and got very active in the church, and you keep thinking how, the pastor cannot do that, because, well, I mean, they do some of that, but it's each member of the congregation doing it, and sometimes the kids, being less shy, do it better than their parents.
Yeah. I'd like to share something. I've experienced both the job that I was pushed into and the vocation I've been called to. I spent 12 years in retail managing stores, and at the time, I guess you could say I rationalized that as that as a Christian in that job, at least I knew I was treating people kindly, respectfully, where they might get different treatment by someone else. Of course, that would be against company policy if they were, but I almost did a better job at it because I was a Christian. After 12 and a half years, I quit my job and went back to school and finished my degree, and I'm now a teacher, and I've been teaching since December. And since December, two of my students at different times have come up to me and said, "Are you a Christian or do you go to church?" And respond, "Yes." And they said, "I thought so. I could tell just by the way you treat us." In the 12 years in retail, no one ever asked me if I was a Christian because of the way I treated them in the store. But that two fifth graders are perceptive enough to pick that up.
I was going to say that Todd, the teacher's aide here, and so you watch the way kids swarm around him, and so on. You can tell certain people make a real difference.
Dr. Martin Luther wrote quite a bit about this whole issue too, about vocation and calling. And I remember in seminary they shared a story of him being approached at the time that he had already. And was approached by a bunch of the peasants who were really excited about, you know, what he had to share from the pulpit in terms of grace. And they came up, a number of them came up and said, you know, Doctor, we feel like we do nothing, and we feel that our, in order to respond to God's calling, we should all become ministers of cloth like you. And he responded by saying, no, I need you all where you are, and God needs you where you are to serve out your calling. And kind of, I think he was getting at the exact mm-hmm. thing that you're talking about, to live off their faith, and you know that they had their ways of service in the community that was very as much as was very integral to that community as his calling as a minister. At least that's the way he communicated. And the quote that I saw, and I always found that kind of profound too.
And Luther's idea that translating the.
I think that kind of inspired his whole idea of the priesthood of all believers. Right. That you know,
and you translate the Bible to the people's language. Yeah, yeah. And you know, I think that's until that time that he helped expand our concept of vocation from just the priesthood of ordained people to everyone.
I think one of the things we need to be aware of in our economy. Is that there's a deliberate attempt, at least with some corporate groups, to try to strive for one's identity and one's loyalty to the corporation, and that people are deliberately moved and kept, you know, the whole bonds of community are broken constantly in order to maintain that loyalty to the corporate structure. And I think if we don't address that in the church as far as vocation, I think we're doing a real disservice to people, because I think we need to see the competition that there's always there between the faith community and the corporate community as far as where one's loyalty, where one's identity, where one's values are. And you see that a lot with the larger corporations, but even some of the smaller ones, it may be a little more subtle, but the whole thing is that if your life doesn't revolve around that business and that identity, then you're not going to make it within that structure.
That may be, again, the tension we always have of living in the world, not of it. And I don't know how you address that kind of issue, and again, a whole lot of businesses have different kinds of attitudes towards people. I mean, it made national news when an employer a couple years ago in Massachusetts, whose factory burned down, 7-year-old, he made a commitment to rebuilding them and promised to pay them for as much of the time as he could until the new place was built for while they were not working, and very generous, concerned employer who was concerned about his employees made national news, and everybody said, wow, how unique this is. I'm not sure it's one of a kind, but unfortunately there are too many others where it's not that way. But aside from whether it's a compassionate employer to the employees, is the business succeed through manipulation, or does it try and promote good, or does it look simply at the bottom line, which is obviously common?
I think you demonstrated one of the strategies for getting at that by reciting your baptismal date. It seems to me that's a key to a lot of it, is to know your baptismal date as surely, and to celebrate it as surely as you celebrate your birthday. That is to say, on this day, at a time certain, in a place certain, with witnesses, you know, God's love was promised to me, and that can never change. Before I was anything, before I could prove anything, before I could do anything, I was valued. And it seems to me that really is one of my strategies for getting at a vocational life that's baptismally oriented, instead of taking on the corporate structure or nomenclature or identity that others would have you take on. First, you are God's child. And how many know your baptismal date? That's it's a good thing to know and to think about once in a while. It is good.
I had a friend who, not a friend, but an associate from Twin Cities who contacted me last year and said, yeah, they met, the guy's wife had been an organist at the minister who baptized me his church a number of years ago, and oh, he's 96 or 98 years old now or so, and still was driving a car at the time, and I thought, oh, great. I had no contact with the guy for 40 years now, and this they brought back. I recognized it because my parents had our baptismal things framed on the wall, and I had seen the name many times, didn't have a clue who it was, and 40 years later, somebody made the connection with him, and he kept track of us. Other comments?
I have a question instead of a comment. Are we not actually caught in the societal web of trying to make it as everybody else? That sometimes when we are out in the world working, with the working agenda ahead of us, that we forget who we are, apart from the work we do. Until we finish that and hit the church's door. How many of us remember in the struggle and bustle and fussing at work that this is who am I? I'm a Christian worker and I can make a difference. I mean, let's be honest. Everybody is trying to make it. And so I think the web and the greed and everything that has been so much of a part of what is going on, unless we start to address that. Every time it's like how much you own is how much respect you get. How much you've made it is how people are going to recognize you. I mean, you can just count on and on and on and on. And how many Christians will say, I have just one car and it's enough for my family, so I have a neighbor who can really not pull it, and I have another car sitting here, and why don't I really help this neighbor with this old car? I mean, there is a lot that when we are really going to think as Christians and we are going to really make a difference and we are thinking about our priorities, there are so many things we will have to do.
I'm not sure that that is a question as much as a comment, but I think it's a good comment. And I like your if anyone has two cars and his neighbor has none. I mean, Christ, if anyone has two coats and his neighbor has none. But again, it's not just the work where we forget that. I mean, it's in the home life and with friends where the people we love most are the ones we yell at most, and we understand that that's not right, but we still do it, and it's not just in our material gaining of possessions, as you said, or in our jobs or in our home life. I mean, everything we do, and you're part of your vocation being to pray when people ask what you do, and that's part of it. I think that's pretty important, so we can remember those other 6.5 days of the week who we are. But I think it's not just the workplace, and you had yourself suggested a couple of things.
There is one plus I will say about our system in the United States, and that is that I'm sure glad to be retired.
What?
I'm sure glad to be retired. Even though I enjoyed my life of work for pay with a telephone office company, I feel stronger about how I can use my time now than I have ever. I do feel sad for some retirees that choose to only benefit themselves. And they say, well, we deserve this. Yeah. So we're going to go play golf, or we're going to go south, or whatever. and then they never really grasp the importance of helping people that have less.
Are you busier now than before you retired?
Oh.
It's amazing how many retirees are that way. And I like your comment, because I've often wondered when I see people taking early retirement at 55 and so on, which there are a number of occupations. In Minnesota, a lot of police and firefighters and everyone, I mean, retirement's 55. And now with life expectancy where it is, it's a 30-year vacation for some people. And where else could you find a better resource for tutoring kids who are at risk, or any of 50,000 things that need doing? And I appreciate your seeing the blessings of retirement as other ways to serve.
Also, it's no longer a world of one career. So many people, like myself, change careers midlife. Two or three, you don't find too many people who've worked 38 years for the same company anymore, or even the same occupation, with more than one company. And I guess it's fortunate for some of us who don't answer the call the first time or hear it, that we have the opportunity to try something new and to realize that what we're doing isn't satisfying to us or meeting our need to meet other needs.
We're lucky to have opportunities where, I mean, in terms of how what we do for our employment, I mean, many societies you don't have the choice now. In past history, you didn't have the choice. You did what your family's done for years, or you don't. I mean, you just don't have many choices, and we have so many, in many ways to serve, even if they're not all exactly the way we would have foreseen it.
John, there's not a lot of vocations where people get to agree or disagree whether or not that should be your vocation. And I'm wondering, you know, in politics, where people say yes or no to you, how that colors your perspective on your vocation.
Could you clarify that a little bit more in terms of the people saying yes or no?
Well, you may still feel a call to the political life, but the voters in Roseville may next time decide that someone else should have that call. most of us don't face that.
I understand it now. That's the one thing about elective office is that many people have job reviews every year, or every couple years, or something else. But usually, it's not something like you have to have an affirmative decision by somebody. Yeah, okay, we'll keep you on for another few years. And we very much have that. We have a lot of bosses that way too. It's not like one person makes the call for you. I guess in that sense, I would say, I don't see my calling as being a state senator. I see my calling as trying to change the way certain injustices in society through public policies and other means. And the one way I've been given the opportunity by the voters, again, because they're the ones who gave me the opportunity. They've given me that opportunity to carry out my call in that way. If they choose not to renew that opportunity, then I, like anybody else who loses the job for whatever reason, they find new ways, one, to support themselves, and two, as Christians, new ways to carry out their vocation.
I thought you just went straight to the Kennedy School at Harvard.
Ah, lots of people do.
You get voted out, you go straight to
go there. The teacher, yes. So, any other last comments or wrap-up things or thoughts? How many people do thinking about vocation here at Holden, people who are, I mean, a lot of you feel you came here in part because of searching for what next?
No, I came because of the food.
Food. This year, there have been some years I haven't been as impressed with the food. Love tonight.
I said that with confidence. Even though I do like
it. I've very much enjoyed it this year. There have been some years where the kids often don't like it, but this year's been very good.
That's a good question you asked, though, because this community is such a community of folks in transition. And struggling with that question about calling. I just had a conversation with someone until 2 o'clock this morning on this subject about their sense of call. And, you know, I know that that was our history too, my wife and I, as we came here 7 years ago, that we were at that point of searching and asking those questions. I think this community is a wonderful place to be empowered as one's trying to identify God's call, no matter what shape or form that takes, in the priesthood of all believers.
Well, I know I personally, every time I come here, I feel a need to come here, partly because this is a good place to examine where I am and where I want to be headed, and what is our call, and how is it moving forward. So I know I do that, and I sort of sense that there are a whole lot of people. I don't know if Martin came here for 5 years for that purpose. I hope a lot of people who come here also see this as, obviously see it as part of their call, because not just because they're doing it for lengthy periods of time, but because I think we all, I like to see how people want to volunteer and want to help, and that you need some help with something, and somebody does step in and do it. And not that it all goes as smoothly as we'd like, but like, not anybody volunteered to take my garbo duty this morning.
I guess, John, part of the concern I have, though, is
yes, I was called.
So many young people coming out of college are coming out with such tremendous debt that they don't feel they have the ability to take the year, or, you know, to do the voluntary service and things like that, to check out some other possibilities, that so often they feel like they have to get right in and start earning to pay that back. And so that becomes a public policy issue in the sense of how we address that. And it's an issue, I think, within the church of what we do with our young people and how we find ways of supporting them and encouraging to look around before jumping in.
Jumping into a career that...
Right.
And again, to the extent it's a public policy issue, I think there has been, let me say, there's growing recognition of the problem, but the answer is not coming as fast as the problem gets worse, both with the AmeriCorps type of thing. Minnesota has a similar type of thing where you serve for a year, post or pre-higher education, and as a result, you get a stipend to pay living expenses and little more. And then you also get financial aid for upcoming higher education, or you can get deferral of loan payments or some other help with that. And certainly, I know in Minnesota, there's a lawyers group who has established and trying to expand on a program that says if you go into public service law, that they will help pay off school loans from law school. And when the difference between a starting lawyer at certain corporate law firms and cities may be starting out a law school for the top students, close to six figures, and others in, I know one attorney in Minnesota who's a public interest lawyer for a nonprofit, and I think he's paid $22,000 a year. He was one of the top two or three in his class at Harvard Law School 16 or 18 years ago, and he's not doing it for the money, and there are many others who would love to do things like that but can't afford to, and that is a public issue.